Okay. On behalf of the Archives Committee and Political Affairs Division, I would like to welcome you all to this book talk. It's a particularly exciting day. You say, why archives with building integrity and corruption? Well, today is International Archives Day, and public sector archives are in fact devoted to government accountability, government transparency, and access to information by the public. So accountability both within the government, but also facing their public. And the NATO Archives Committee was established in 1999 with the NATO Archives to bring these elements into NATO and to ensure that NATO is actually living up to the same responsibilities that our member nations do at home. And so it's a great pleasure to actually contribute to the Building Integrity Initiative with our work and to coordinate this event. And with that, I'd like to introduce Susan Pond, who will tell us a bit more about today's event.
Thank you very much, Catherine, and thank you to my colleagues in the IS and IMS and delegations who have joined us today. I have to say, I didn't know today was International Archives Day, but it shows you one of my themes is that building integrity is a cross-cutting agenda item. And for those of you who might have been surprised to see the posters, and what does NATO have to do with corruption and crime, terrorism is well known to us, of course, as a topic here. But I want to make the case that NATO has been promoting good governance and transparency, accountability, integrity in the defense security sector from the beginning of the alliance in 1949. It's been a priority in promoting transparency and defense budgeting. And civil and democratic control of the armed forces, for example, just two examples I would offer you. What is new is our recognition of corruption as a security risk. And this is reflected in the BI policy, which is endorsed at the Warsaw Summit. And for the very few of you who may not know about the BI policy, we have copies here at the table at the side that you can become better acquainted with the policy. The division that I work for, the Political Affairs and Security Policy Division, has the lead on implementation of this effort. We work with our military colleagues very closely to understand the impact of corruption in our operations and drawing lessons learned. And we also work closely with nations providing tailored support to individual nations. And these are nations who request assistance, and we can provide tailored support in assessing the risks that they face in their particular country and a strategy of how to strengthen their transparency and accountability and integrity within the systems and the practices that they have in their defense and security sector. We're now 10 years old as of this year. We're now celebrating the 10th anniversary of building integrity as a program. And we'd like to think we've had a number of successful achievements. Most important, perhaps, is the establishment of building integrity as a NATO education and training discipline. We're the 29th discipline. We work very closely with our colleagues at ACT. And this, we think, will have a long-term impact because, as our military colleagues know, you spend a lot of your time focused on education, training, and exercises. When you're not in operations, you're doing probably one of those activities. We have now somewhere between 10 and 12, I think, courses that have been certified by ACT and the department head, which is the Center for Integrity in the Defense Sector in Norway, as our partner there. And we would expect more courses to be certified in the coming years, and BI to be included in existing courses on logistics and intelligence, to name a few. But we are working closely with nations and with institutions like the NATO School in Oberammergau to review their curriculum and insert BI into existing courses. And if you'd like to know more about that, we have a reference curriculum, and the BI team would be happy to discuss how we can help your nation take on this work. We've established a network of institutions, both in the public and the private sector, to help us take this work forward. And perhaps the most significant steps taken last year in the development of the BI policy and an action plan. And I think for this audience, what may be interesting to know is that the policy is 360 degrees. And by that, I mean that we have applied the policy NATO-wide. So the NATO staff, NATO agencies are bound by this policy as well, and we use it in developing our cooperation. So the members of the NATO staff in the last few days will have received information from executive management circulating the code of conduct, which applies to all staff, as a reminder of the standards of practice that you would expect from NATO staff. So that's an example of the policy applying to our to ourselves as well. We have, of course, all NATO allies, 29 now as of this week, have endorsed the policy. Our PFP partners have associated themselves to the policy, and we've invited our other partners to join us. And as of today, both Australia and Colombia have associated themselves to the policy. I joke that we've started at the beginning of the alphabet, and we'll work our way way through in time. So that's a little bit about building integrity, and the reason we've invited Louise to be with us is that we're interested in developing evidence-based policy as we take this work forward. And as you might expect, there's not a lot of research in this area. There's lots of research on corruption and the impact of corruption in a general way, but not linking it to the security and defense sector. And that's what NATO is interested in. So we see this as part of our consultations as we begin the process of shaping our program for 2018 to 2020. We want to consult with those who are doing research in this area, and Louise is a good example, so that we can take her knowledge and adapt it and take advantage of it as we're developing our work going forward. Now, Louise is a very accomplished individual. She's written the book that you, mine, you see, is all battered up. I've been reading it and passing it around to my colleagues in the division. She's previously had a Rockership Fellow, and she's currently an Andrew Carnegie Fellow, and she's had funding for the last 2 years to address global issues, and this is certainly meets that remit. She's also revealed to us that she, in a long time ago, was recipient of a Science for Peace grant. So I think maybe it's time that you make another application, Louise. So she's not entirely new to the NATO process. She is founder and executive director of the Terrorism, Transnational Crime and Corruption Center at the George Mason University. So she's written a number of books. This book, she's also written a book on human trafficking and crime and non-punishment. I will let her explain to you how she sees corruption, crime, and terrorism linked. I found her book very informative. It demonstrates that this challenge is transnational, and it touches every nation. And we see just recently with the attacks both in the UK and France and here in Belgium that the link between corruption and terrorism, if only if you think of weapons that are leaving theaters of operation, And ending up on the streets in Europe and used against the population. So there is a direct link that impacts the security of faraway places, but also here in the streets where the NATO headquarters is situated. So, Louise, with that introduction, can I give you the floor for you to share with us your research? And then we have Lieutenant Colonel Sebastian Grima and Dr. Juliette Bird, who will lead us off in a discussion. So, Louise, you have the floor.
Thank you so much, Susan, for the lovely introduction, and it's a great honor for me to be with you today. And it's certainly a very interesting audience to share my thoughts with, and I look forward to a lively exchange after the panel. As Susan mentioned, I've been on this Andrew Carnegie Fellowship, and now I'm finishing a book on illicit trade, which is what I think of as the end of this trilogy, the first one of human trafficking, which I concluded would be a defining issue for the 21st century, dirty entanglements, and now illicit trade, which I presaged in this book. But let me give you two examples of how this phenomenon has changed since the book that are, I think, particularly relevant to you as members of the defense community. So one of your priorities here is the cyber world and cyber crime, cyber activity. So I'll start off with an illustration from the U.S. to show you that everybody is part of the problem, and we are part of it too. So a few years ago, there was a major criminal website on the dark net called Silk Road, which some of you may have heard about. And the person who was running Silk Road, it was discovered, was named someone named Ross Ulbricht, but he went under the name of Dread Pirate Roberts. What was unusual about Dread Pirate Roberts, as opposed to most criminals, is that he had been an Eagle Scout. An Eagle Scout is the highest level of Boy Scout, you know, with the greatest achievement in this area. So he should be somebody with integrity. But that seems to have gone missing, as he, within 3 years, built a website that trafficked in every kind of drugs, but also provided the service of hitmen, weapons, everything that you could find. And as this site was brought down, it had done a turnover of $1.2 billion of trade within this relatively short period, which shows you how much these phenomena of crime, corruption, and terrorism have scaled in the few years since I finished Dirty Entanglements. Now, where does the issue of corruption come in? About in January at my university, there was a wonderful conference on the dark net. And one of the investigators of the Silk Road investigation reported that two of his fellow investigators of this case were now in prison. Why were they in prison? Because instead of investigating the crime, they had gone to the dark side, and they began to steal the bitcoins that were being used to process the financial transactions, and they also began feeding information to Dread Pirate Roberts on the investigation so he could protect himself. So they are now in prison for 7 years apiece out of two federal agencies in the United States government. And you understand that what they're trafficking was not just of interest to criminals, but are weapons and other kinds of activities that could be used by terrorists. So what this shows, and I think is very important to understand, that cybercrime and cyber activity is not separate from what I've laid out in dirty entanglements. It is just a new method of operation that is more effective and that you can generate more revenue, reach more people, and do it more rapidly. But human beings operate like human beings, and when they go into the cyber world, they operate the way they do in normal activity. And that's important to understand, that one is dealing with technology, but what we need to understand are the basics of how this technology works. And Mr. Dread Pirate Roberts, who had been a Boy Scout, a law-abiding citizen, was paying in Bitcoin to hire hitmen to take out his competitors. So it shows the incredible corrupting experience for human beings of participating in this kind of illegal activity. Beyond that, let's look at some of the issues that are also burning issues for you of what is going on in Syria and the Middle East. If you want to think about how the problems of the uprising in Syria started, it is also a combination of these three elements. And much of the problems in Syria started with an illicit trade in water. And that's one of the issues that I'm taking on in this new work, is how much we're dealing with illicit trade in natural resources. But one of the problems is that Assad's government was giving and selling illegally, through corruption, licenses to drill for water, until there was no more water during a drought, and millions of Syrians moved from rural areas to urban areas. In fact, there was one of the fastest rural to urban migrations going on in Syria in the period before the uprising that one can notice in the world, according to demographers and research scientists. And when these rural Syrians moved to urban areas, they encountered a very corrupt environment where they settled in fringe, informal cities, which there were no social services because of the corruption. And if you look at a correlation of where this conflict started and where these rural refugees from the drought and the corruption lived, this is the heart of where the part of the problem was. So we see a very close correlation between the corruption and the criminal activity, the migration, and the foundation that has led and been such a fertile ground for terrorism. So this is, you know, the ongoing story. It has not ended with dirty entanglements, and it plays out both in the enormous conflicts that we're facing and you're facing as people associated with NATO or working for NATO, and you're seeing it in the cyber world. And I think it's very important to think about not just the relationship of crime and terrorism, but crime, terrorism, corruption, because I think if you think of just two elements, you're sitting on a two-legged stool rather than a three-legged stool, which is what you need for some stability. I started off the book, Dirty Entanglements, going through the most deadly attacks of the 2000s to show that corruption was a part of every major most deadly terrorist attack that we knew. And these terrorist attacks were not just in Afghanistan, they were not just in the Middle East, but the most deadly attacks were distributed across many different continents in the world. So let me give you a few examples of the corruption that were associated with the most deadly attacks. For example, the 9/11 attack was a result or was aided by hijackers who obtained driver's licenses through corruption in the Department of Motor Vehicles in Northern Virginia. And I was working with some investigators with Migration Service in the U.S., with the INS, before 9/11, because we were working on some counter-trafficking training. And they knew about this corruption in the motor vehicles department, but it was so small compared to some of the other problems that it wasn't prioritized. But it is this petty corruption that can also facilitate terrorism. There were also a language school that was providing visas for individuals in a corrupt way. And I first came across this in looking at a case of human trafficking in which the prostitutes were being given visas to work in the United States by this fake language school. But it was also providing visas to the 9/11 hijackers. So that what you have is corruption that intersects between crime and terrorism. Let's look at the Beslan attack in Russia and how that was facilitated by terrorism. That was very much more direct, and you had corrupt members of Russian law enforcement who were actually transporting the terrorists to the site of the attack. They had vehicles, they were paid off, and they moved people. In the Bali attacks, which were orchestrated in Indonesia, you had corruption in the prisons that allowed the mastermind of the attack to raise money on the internet after his incarceration. So I can go on with other examples, but it's there to show you if you look at the attacks in Spain, if you look at the attacks in Mumbai, all of them had corruption that helped be a central part of the actualization of the attack. Corruption is not only these low-level individuals that we are talking about who are failing to do their duty in the prisons, who are transporting terrorists, who are giving out driver's licenses after payment of a bribe. In some areas, with the most acute levels of corruption, as the Transparency International surveys reveal, are ones with very high levels of terrorism. Afghanistan, Iraq, Nigeria, Somalia, countries of North Africa, are ones in which there is high corruption and high rates of terrorism. And this is not coincidental, because we're going to look at what corruption does to society and why it is so corrosive. If we're thinking now of ISIS, oil funding is possible for ISIS because of the smuggling of the oil. And according to the Kurdish press, the very high levels of corruption that exist in Kurdistan and neighboring countries helps facilitate this trade that has made ISIS viable. So why does this correlation between corruption and terrorism exist? First of all, kleptocrats drain the resources from countries and there is no investment and limited future for the youth who are there. And unfortunately for us, many of the participants in crime, many of the participants in terrorism are youthful, and therefore the absence of futures for them is an important driver of their involvement in the illicit economy. Secondly, when there's high levels of corruption, there is limited faith in the government and in the state. And citizens are often dismayed at corruption and will not bear arms for the state. They're not supportive of it. They're not going to go out and defend a corrupt society. I've heard from many, well, corruption is normal there. It's normal in this society. But for many of you who've worked in Afghanistan and many people who I interviewed for this book who spent time working against corruption in Afghanistan, there is certainly not the level of corruption today that there was historically. The problem has gotten worse. The presence of a massive drug trade that has come out of Afghanistan, but not just drugs, trade in timber, trade in gems, trade in natural resources, had led to an enormous corruption at the top of the government that has undermined faith in the state. And when so many resources are stolen by the state, and the kleptocrats show so little interest for their society, the society is not providing basic services, medical care, schools, education, even sports teams may be provided by criminals and sometimes terrorists who are substituting as service providers for the state. And this is a real problem because increasingly we are having fracturing of states and non-state actors assuming a more important role, not just as employers, but as service providers. And the failures to address corruption can lead to terrorists embedding themselves within society. We've seen this in Afghanistan, we're seeing this in Iraq and Syria, and we're seeing how these organizational failures of the state are leading to these problems. And they are, as I've talked about in the book, there are certain important hubs where these problems are particularly problematic. For example, the city of Karachi, which has problems of crime, terrorism, corruption that make these operating hubs for many of the problems that we are looking at. We can see them also in Nigeria and other places as well. In my latest work on illicit trade, I go back to some of the history that laid the background for this. And Karachi was one of the hubs during the Opium Wars, and that involvement in drug trade has just resurged with other actors involved today. So what are the principal issues that we see in this for NATO? First of all, we're going to be seeing more and more conflict in the cyber world. And I think it's important to understand how much the cyber world is a translation of what we see in the real world to the cyber world, and how much the cyber world is creating its own forms of criminality, like malware, like botnets, that are new products tied to cyber. But I think it's also important to go back into history. And when we talk about pirates in history, we had pirates like Drake, who made money as a pirate, but who also worked as a pirate on behalf of the English state. So we've always had this combined function of piracy for personal gain and piracy for state gain. And we're seeing this same transfer into the cyber world. And so I think when we're looking at cyber, it's very important to understand how our understanding of dirty entanglements or our understanding of historical relationships and how we address these issues before can be translated into the new medium, rather than just thinking of this as a new technical problem that we have to solve. In Dirty Entanglements, I devoted a chapter to the illicit trade in WMD components, and I think this is very significant. It is a problem that is not going away, and we have to think about this as one of the most pernicious elements of illicit trade, in which criminals, terrorists, but also corrupt business people and states are engaged. And it's important not to think just about our problems of transnational crime as traditional crime groups, but networks that can involve states, networks that can involve businesses, and to think more broadly about where we are and who is committing this transnational criminality. You're also focused on the problems of energy security. And we're looking at the ISIS example, which is the largest example of illicit trade in energy funding terrorism, but it's certainly an important element in the history of the Ukraine-Russia conflict. It's a problem in Nigeria with Boko Haram. It's a problem and has been with the FARC in Colombia. In fact, petrochemicals was always a part of natural resources of the funding of the FARC. So we're looking at a problem of a target of opportunity for terrorists and criminals. For migration, this has changed dramatically, not just the problems of migrants, flows and what they're doing to state stability, but what is driving some of this migration. And I've written a recent piece on this that's going to be published, and also in my new book I'm addressing this problem of what is going on in North Africa and sub-Saharan Africa as people with states that are not providing for their needs because of corruption, because of governance failures, because of climate change, are fleeing, and they're fleeing to Southern Europe, to this region, and this is providing an enormous security challenge for Europe, an enormous security challenge for countries in Africa, particularly in North Africa, that don't have the resources to handle this massive population migration. And there are just two other things that we need to think about, is that there are problems of leadership, that there are countries in which you have the leadership involved in this criminal activity. An example in Venezuela is the president of Venezuela and his nephews and close family members have been involved in narcotics trade. The same was true in Afghanistan, and we can think of other kinds of involvement in illicit trade of top leadership. So this is an issue that goes from the top to the bottom of society. What has increasingly changed, and beyond what I was writing about in Dirty Entanglements, is the spread of cell phones and communications. So centuries ago, when Braudel was writing about trade in the Mediterranean and touched on the problem of illicit trade. It was primarily an urban phenomenon. It was a port phenomenon. But now with new communications, this is a problem that extends to rural areas and integrates the 7 billion people of our continent, of the world. Approximately 5 billion of them are now integrated into modern-day communications and can be both perpetrators and victims of this criminal activity. So it's operating on a dimension that we have never seen before in world history. And that's what's very significant in its transformation and sort of the next phase after dirty entanglements. So what do we need to think about as we address the role of corruption and try to come up with some strategies of how to deal with these problems that seem insurmountable? First of all, we need to think about more about partnerships with the private sector, because they see these anomalies in illicit trade. They can be part of the problem, but they can also be part of the solution. Because women are less involved in corruption, because they're excluded from networks of power, but also because they see the costs for their families of absence of medical services, education, access to health care, women need to be part of the solution because they have greater intolerance for corruption. And we also need to stop stovepiping the problem. It is no longer true that drug trafficking exists separately from human trafficking, that exists separately from counterfeit trade. In the US, in Latin America, in Europe, in Africa, all of these phenomena, and in Asia as well, go together. There is an increasing decline in illicit actors dealing solely in one commodity. And we also need to stop stovepiping our security response and saying this is a law enforcement problem or this is a military problem, and to be thinking about how we are guaranteeing and providing security in general. We need to be thinking about how we deal with these issues from a military, from a procurement point of view, and how does one control supply chains and access that reduce corruption? And how we don't exacerbate the problem when we enter into different societies. The first thing is not to make the problem worse. And what can we do about improving this situation? One of the next talks I have to give is on what are the lessons from Georgia, where I have worked, on reducing corruption. It is the only non-Baltic country of the former Soviet space that has seen a significant decline in its score in the transparency in international indices. So while almost all the countries out of the former Soviet Union, except for the Baltics, are well over 100 or 120, meaning among the worst in the world, Georgia is now at 65, at the level of Brazil and Italy, countries that have corruption problems, but also address corruption problems. And the lessons of this are that, one, you need a will at the top to address this issue. You need citizen realization that corruption is destroying the economics and the social values of the society. And one needs to start addressing the major aggravating factors that are making the citizens angry about the corruption. So in Georgia, they started with the education system and with the traffic police, and got rid of many of the police who were most deeply involved in the criminal activity and the the corrupt activity. And I could talk more about this, but it requires something that shows where a society can intervene successfully and where citizens can see a resolution for themselves and their offspring of fighting corruption. And I think that's very, very important because people don't want to wait a decade. They want to see results quickly and to see some satisfaction of what are their irritants from the state. So I'll turn the floor over to the discussants who I know have interesting things to say.
Introduce yourself shortly and then Juliet.
Yeah, thank you very much. My name is Lieutenant Colonel Sebastian Krumer. I've been serving since August 2016 in the International Military Staff in the Policy and Capabilities Division. My personal background, I joined 1997, the German Army, studied history and social sciences, attended the 8th Advanced Staff Course at the Bundeswehr Command and Staff College and the École de Guerre in Paris. 2006, I served in the Congo during the U4RD Congo mission, 2008 in Kunduz, ISAF, and 2015, I was the military assistant to the commander of the Train Advice Assist Command North in Afghanistan during the Resolute Support mission. So my focus during my comments will be on Afghanistan because this is my personal experience. Thanks.
Good morning. I'm Juliette Bird. I'm head of counterterrorism within the Emerging Security Challenges Division. And my background is in intel, analysis of the threat from terrorism, amongst other global threats. I have been in this post for 6 years now, and I'm delighted to be invited to be a discussant. I've never tried being a discussant before, so I have no idea if I will do the right thing. But this is a fascinating opportunity.
And why don't you start then with your comments or questions, Julia?
Are you sure? I don't have a background in Congo and Afghanistan and interesting places. Thank you, then. I will take advantage of that. First of all, to say thank you very much for this. I'm extremely pleased to be a discussant on Louise's three-legged stool of terrorism, transnational crime, and corruption. And it was a very interesting experience to read the book. There's a huge amount of reading has gone into it, a massive number of variety of open source references. As Louise has already said, corruption is recognized as being correlated directly to levels of terrorism. And there are actually very few things that are. There's a very good annual work that's put out called the Global Terrorism Index. And for those non-OECD countries, the corruption index translates across, but with a strong impact, to the levels of terrorism in a country. Corruption is not mentioned explicitly in the UN's Global Counterterrorism Strategy, but it's implicit in there because there are references to lack of rule of law, lack of good governments, lack of functioning judicial system, lack of opportunities for human development, poor education, and many of those things Louise has already spoken about as being fundamentally due to corruption within governments. So when I was reading the book, the areas that, of course, attract my interest are the ones that speak to my day job, as it were. First of all, the corruption-terrorism link, and secondly, the crime-terrorism link. I was also very struck by some of her comments on what I called organizational failures. I don't know whether she approves of this title or not, but it's things that we could have done or could do and are not doing. And also, I might encourage her to come back at the end of this to speak a little more about cities. She mentioned it in her introductory words, but I think with the current ACT project on urbanization and the threats that go with it, that might be something that this audience would be interested to hear a bit more about. So starting on the corruption side, yes, corruption is definitely an enabler. And as Louise said, failure to address it can embed terrorism in society. because with the youth bulge that she referred to, the corruption of the education system leading to undereducation and vulnerability to radicalization and the search for futures that don't exist because they've been eaten, they've been thrown away by the government. All that erodes citizens' trust in government. No social security net. When that side of the government system fails, if you haven't got a job to go to and you haven't got a social security system to look after you, you end up in the situation of the guy with the fruit barrow in Tunisia. Mm-hmm. Just a little anecdote, I think. Louise refers to it as a sort of general issue, but terrorists will step in to fill the gaps that the government leaves. And when NATO sent assistance to Pakistan for the floods, Jamaat al-Dawa, an offshoot of Lashkar-e-Toiba, at the same time was providing humanitarian assistance. So it was kind of NATO against the terrorists to help the population. It's an extraordinary situation. The links between crime and terrorism. I confess right at the beginning, I've always been slightly sceptical about those who point to the crime-terrorism nexus. It's not that I see that there's any difficulty about terrorists using crime or having criminal backgrounds. It's just I don't yet see it, and I'd be interested to hear more. I don't yet see it as a huge networked threat, as it were. Louise, in your book, you described it as global, networked, and interrelated, but you also point to the business logic to terrorism. And the serious organized crime threat assessment of Europol for this year, we did speak about Rob before we came, talks about contacts between terrorists and organized crime groups, but a lack of evidence of sustained contact. And I tend to support that view of things in that there is a business logic that means that terrorists need to use crime groups for commodities that they are in need of. So document fraud for identity, money laundering to fund terrorist attacks, arms trafficking. Yes, they need to buy arms from somewhere, but the interface between crime and terrorism for me has always been a bit more ad hoc, just a question of obtaining what you need from existing networks. In chapter 3 of your book, you say that terrorists seek expertise from crime groups. And I was wondering if there was any evidence, for example, of buying in expertise for bomb builders or financiers or cyber criminals, which you were talking about earlier. Also in chapter 6, I think you talk about hiring in lawyers. So perhaps there are other types of experts that are hired in by terrorist groups. I don't want to go on very long, but I just wanted to highlight the points I found interesting about organizational failures. You spoke briefly about Beslan and your introduction, but in the book you also talk about Beslan being a product of a lack of counterterrorism strategy for the Russian state. And I think that the overexertion of force by the Russian security services was a clear abuse of human rights and failure to plan, failure to be flexible. The fact that they did not negotiate was an enormous oversight, and there are several specialists who speak very movingly on this subject, because actually a bunch of the kids were prepared to were put aside in order to be traded, and the Russians didn't ask, so they didn't get. You talk about prisons as warehouses, and it's even worse than that, of course, because they're also recruiting bases. And as you say, you gave the Bali example, I think, as centres for crimes to be committed from whilst you're incarcerated. So there are things that we know are happening that perhaps we are not addressing as much as we should. you point to mechanisms not being in place to stop attacks, even when the threat is recognised. And this has to be a kind of risk assessment for every case, but even so, you also point in your book to cases where law enforcement are just not enforcing the law. And partly that's because our governments are not necessarily funding the police system to the extent that is necessary. I was also going to just note that terrorist groups also make fairly good employers. When I was working in Mauritania for part of PASP's DEEP project, the military were talking about the children of friends who were going to Mali because they couldn't get jobs, but there were employers on the other side of the border. Those employers were ACMI, Al-Qaeda and the Islamic Maghreb. I like to quote a Louise's. It said, states may mobilize to counter an insurgency, but they cannot counter the corruption, crime, and terrorism that have penetrated other states. And I wanted us to think whether or not actually projecting stability might be a way to contribute to some of those things. When we help partners, are these areas that we are focusing on? I'm conscious I've gone on too long, so I'm going to stop now, but I have plenty more questions. Thank you very much.
I think you've done very
Yeah, Professor Shelley, dear ladies and gentlemen. First of all, I'd like to thank Dr. Susan Pond for the invitation to that panel. For me, it's the first time as well. But this allows me to give you a military perspective on that topic. Furthermore, I would like to thank Professor Shelley for her remarkable presentation based on her book, Dirty Entanglements, and her way ahead of her research. And this is really interesting because she did not stop right now, but she showed us in her presentation how these illicit activities transformed between the end of the book in 2014, I think, and now. So this is moving on. But I focus on that book because I'm not a cyber expert. This book is really a stunning work since the analysis links the three phenomena of corruption, crime, and terrorism and proves it with a very long list of references in the footnotes, like already stated. This book constitutes a real scientific effort which clearly shows the practical implications of corruption, crime, and terrorism for world security and stability. This book is absolutely worthwhile to read because it helps to understand the complexity of the entanglement of corruption, crime, and terrorism. As she states, nowadays, corruption, crime, and terrorism are globally interconnected, are interrelated, and often rely on advanced technologies or expertise, like you mentioned as well. Furthermore, many of them are able to adapt their procedures quickly, which challenge Western institutions and organizations. Though the effects are mostly devastating in the developing world, there are also negative effects on the developed world, either directly by terrorist acts or indirectly by the migration crisis with which Europe is faced now. At the end, the true long-term costs might only be seen with the passage of future decades. As Professor Shelley notes, her work is the first which links corruption, crime, and terrorism. Not every corrupt official or criminal is a terrorist, but terrorism does not work with crime and corruption, and lots of crimes do not work with corruption. We should bear in mind that, knowingly or unknowingly, corrupt behavior, wherever in the world, could facilitate terrorism. Professor Shelley explains widely the business, economic, and financial dimension of the entanglement of corruption, crime, and terrorism, and identified six environments that are disproportionately associated with the interaction of corruption, crime, and terrorism. There's diaspora communities, prisons, as already stated, megacities, ports, multi-border regions, and conflict regions. This shows clearly the global dimension of the problem. However, with regard to the complexity of the topic, her analysis makes me not feel optimistic to eradicate corruption, crime, and terrorism in the near term. But doing nothing is not an option at all, since the criminals and the terrorists will proceed with their illicit and deadly efforts, like she stated in her further work on cyber and illicit trade. So this should be motivation enough for us to meet these challenges. Complex problems can mostly not be tackled with simple answers. They need to be complex. And Professor Shelley proposes answers in the second half of her book. So what can be done? First of all, she proposes conceptualizing the problem. This means that separate strategies fighting corruption, crime, and terrorism have to be now conceptualized as a three-body problem and should not be stovepiped, as she already stated in her presentation. Second, more profound and independent analysis. After the Cold War, historical links of the two former superpowers to different regions in the world established through education, research, and training exchanges vanish today. She regrets the loss of in-depth knowledge of language in diverse societies. Professor Shelley states that a greater understanding of history, geography, culture, demography, society, networks, economics, business, and technology is needed. Third, comprehensive strategy. She proposes the whole of society perspective. The approach to address crime, terrorism, and corruption with a whole government approach, integrating military, law enforcement, and financial countermeasures with development assistance is too narrow. Professor Shelley thrives for a holistic, namely a whole of society approach, which requires a response from the global community, consisting of multilateral organizations, international local business, consumers, religious and secular civil society, journalists and international online communications, researchers and educational institutions. So she referred in her presentation to the use of mobile phones and the fast spread of information, which endangers us as well. Fourth, a financial approach to crime and terrorism involving business and consumers. Fifth, human capital and a greater role for women. She referred to that as well. And at least containing the harm of countermeasures. With this proposal, Professor Shelley criticizes the excessive reliance on technology on the one hand, like the use of combat drones and unauthorized invasions of privacy with data collection. So please allow me now to comment from a military perspective. First of all, Professor Shelley's proposals remain on a high political strategic level, which raise the question how to operationalize it and which international institution is capable and accepted enough to bring all these loose ends together. I hope you can discuss this later on. In principle, I support her idea of conceptualizing the problem and her vision of a whole society approach. NATO supports the comprehensive approach, which aims exactly on more than only a whole-of-government approach. According to the Warsaw Communique, the Comprehensive Approach Action Plan of 2011 has to be updated, which is right now ongoing. The international military staff, based on informal contributions of the two strategic commands, provided an input to that, which, amongst other things, reflects the findings that a conflict could not be solved with military means only. Furthermore, the international military staff, supported by the strategic commands, contributed to the development of the Building Integrity Policy and the Building Integrity Action Plan with, at that time, 28 nations agreed military advice, in which the holistic and cross-cutting nature of building integrity activities was acknowledged. Corruption and bad governance is seen as a risk for stability and might have a devastating impact on military operations. Building integrity will influence our concepts and doctrines. And, as already stated as well, for several years, ACT, supported by ACO, works on an urbanization project which reflects the challenge of the challenges of megacities you described in your book and the problems with it as well. The military committee agreed on military advice on the proceed of this project as well 2 months ago, I think. Yeah, with regard to Afghanistan, I do not want to discuss the success or failure of the current strategy like you stated in your book here, but that strategy developed first in the Petersburg process 2001-2002 might have been too narrow and has not reflected the whole society approach. Some of these ideas might have been too idealistic and in some aspects too naive, especially with regard to the history, society, culture, tradition, religion, economy, and or the involvement of the old strong power brokers and warlords. Thus, a more in-depth analysis of the whole context, as described by Professor Shelley, is indispensable before a mission starts. But please bear in mind that according to the UN Security Council Resolution 1386, the NATO-led International Security and Assistance Force ISAF mission, the military was only one part of the Petersburg process. In my opinion, all military efforts can only be sustainable and enduring if they are thoroughly embedded into a sound political strategy and be financially supported and sustained. I cannot go into detail here, but let me give you an example. With the Resolute Support mission, which has succeeded the ISAF mission since January 2015, the military has been involved in the training, advice, and assistance of the Afghan National Security Forces. Generally spoken, all efforts promoting transparency and accountability will be hampered if the ordinary soldier or policeman does not get on time a sufficient salary for feeding his family. And this could be an easy solution to counter corruption, but this needs an international effort to provide the finance for that. Give these people a correct salary, a decent salary, that they can live and that they can live and their family live from that. I am convinced that the military remains crucial, amongst other things, in controlling of a territory or in defense capacity building. But we should accept that all honest Western principles like transparency and accountability might overwhelm some societies in some developing regions of the world directly implemented at once on the ground. So we should think about an iterative process for its implementation which respects the religiously, historically, and culturally crown circumstances. For example, if you blame a military commander who you assist in a defense capacity building mission to be corrupt, he might be stopped the cooperation. Mostly, we as a Western community are invited to assist. And so we have to respect this as well. And if he stops cooperation, then nothing is won. In many of our military concepts, we request a so-called local ownership, and you referred to that as well. For example, we contract local enterprises to support our missions. We should bear in mind that lots of these enterprises are run or controlled by local power brokers, which might be highly corrupt. All NATO missions have not only all NATO, but all other UN missions and so on have an economic impact in a region per se because of the money and the commodities we bring in. So we should reflect on how to mitigate non-intended negative effects with regard to corruption. For example, in Kinshasa, the prices for renting an apartment rose after the UN and the EU4 entered. Or, Matthias, we discussed it in advance, when an Afghan assistant in cleaning our barracks there has a university degree and earns much more than a university professor in Afghanistan. This promotes corruption, not transparency. And we should bear that in mind. So I think this should be enough for the moment to trigger a discussion. Again, Professor Shelley, thank you very much for your presentation and your book. I'm absolutely sure that all policymakers, either from the political or military side, can draw lots of good ideas out of your book. I personally can recommend this academic work because of its sound analysis and deductions. It will enrich our conceptual and strategic thinking. Thank you very much for your attention.
Thank you very much, Sebastian. I would propose that we go directly to the audience for questions and comments, and then I'll come back to Dr. Shelley for her to make some final remarks. So Michaela is ready with the microphone. You're all being very shy.
Is it already switched on? Yes, it is. Thank you for your presentation. First of all, my name is Matthias Voss. I'm a lieutenant colonel for the German Army as well, but that's coincidence. I'm really interested in the topic. And not only after your presentation, but before reading your book, I have one question I've been thinking about for quite a while. And I'd be interesting whether you agree or not that there is a certain level of corruption that needs to be accepted. small amount of residual corruption in any society, which might depend on the character of the society. Of course, you mentioned the example of the United States. I wouldn't consider the United States per se as a corrupt country, but nevertheless, even there, there was enough corruption to make the attacks of 9/11 possible. And if you transfer that to the less developed countries, to countries with a larger corruption problem, do we need to accept a certain level? You always have the limits of personal liberty, of practicability also, and the latter is of most importance for us when we enter with NATO or EU or UN into a country. Of course, we don't like corruption, but nevertheless, do we have to accept it to a certain degree? Thank you very much.
Thank you. Other questions or comments? I think over here.
My name is Ine Crisano. I'm the NATO archivist, and I have a question on behalf of the members of the Archives Committee who are in the audience today. I wanted to ask you, and thank you very much to all of the panel for a very interesting discussion, but what do you think the role could be, or what message would you have to archivists to assist in fighting corruption? And I'm thinking about the discussions that we have had in the past 3 days. One of them was our goal in preserving the records or the evidence based of NATO operations. So what advice would you give us? Thank you.
Do we have any other questions right here?
I'm Vicky Nielsen. I work for public diplomacy here. I'm actually from Denmark, which is known as one of the least, if not the least, corrupt country.
Want to be like Denmark.
Don't want to brag, but I'd be interested in, to know what you think are the secret ingredients for a non-corrupt country.
I think there was one more. Did I see? Oh, way in the back over here, Michaela. Or sorry, here and then.
Yes, my name is Lars Rostal. I'm Swedish. I am a real estate developer here in Brussels. My question is about the role of the large internet companies like Google or Facebook. They have a role, an important role here. And do they really help to control all this corruption? Do they do anything? Some of the politicians, like the English Prime Minister, raised that issue a few days ago. So I would like to know if you have any information about what they have done recently and if they have any plans to help reduce this, the corruption on the cyber world. Thank you.
Okay, and I think there was one back here, and then I'll turn it over to Louise and our panel to take up these issues.
Good morning, my name is Mariana Ippolito. Corruption, crime, and terrorism have easily and quickly adapted to globalization. What can be done globally to fight this tendency? Because it has been transferred more from the national business to the international business.
Thank you. Okay, so we have a very rich range of questions directed to Louise and our panel. Louise, I'm going to start with you if you'd like to tackle these questions.
All right.
Get through as many as we can with the remaining time.
All right. These are great questions. So the first question was, is there a residual level of corruption? And I would say that in societies where we're talking about residual levels, there's always exchange relationships and that exist in almost every society. And but what we've seen in countries like Afghanistan or what we're seeing in the Middle East now are levels of corruption that these societies never knew, which are so destabilizing. So I think that this is, we're never going to totally erase corruption. And even authoritarian societies that try to do this wind up having corruption. But what we need to do and worry about is that where this corruption just becomes so excessive and destabilizes the society and the values of the community. And that was certainly going on in Afghanistan, and it's going on elsewhere. The question for archivists, I think it's that history matters. And whether it's recent history or future history, but as I'm writing my new book, I'm going back to Mesopotamia and looking at Hammurabi's code and the evolution of the phenomenon of fencing of stolen goods from Hammurabi's code to e-fencing today. And it gives you a sense of proportion. And you need to understand whether you're dealing with something that is qualitatively different or whether you're dealing with new phenomena, which gets back also to your question of residual levels of corruption. And also the question of organizational failures and whether one is making the situation worse. And I think that's part of why we need to be examining the past to make sure that we're not replicating errors, because in the cyber world, whatever gets replicated now gets replicated on a level that gets aggravated even faster, which goes to Lars's question about Google and Facebook, which is the issue I'm writing about now as I'm trying to finish my book on illicit trade, and also this emphasis on why the private sector is so important on this issue today, is that we developed, or the global community developed, these new technologies, but a lot of them were developed in the United States, in an idea that we were going to share information with not much attention to security. And most of security, like a NATO, is state-sponsored. But when so much of what is going on in the world of trade and exchange of information is held in private hands, it is up to them to be policing a lot of this activity. And that becomes an added cost that many of them don't want to expend. And that is a real reason that some of this has scaled. And it's not just a problem in the West. I was in Hangzhou about 2 years ago, which is where Alibaba was started. And there were people, I was visiting a police academy, and many of them had left the police academy to go work at Alibaba because they needed to police their web presence. But it's still not enough. There are just massive amounts of counterfeits and other forms of illicit activity that is going on in China despite this. So it's a question of costs and profits, and how much can you distribute to this when the vehicles for change are in private hands. And it's the first time that a huge sector of security is not something of which states have control over. So it's not just a question, as I talked about in Dirty Entanglements, of non-state actors substituting for the state, but of non-state actors having control over citizen security, like their identity and the trade or their computers and their other systems that are outside of state control. And it's just an enormous challenge we're not thinking enough about, which is also why I start off with Dread Pirate Roberts and the amount of resources it takes to police this dark web. What can be done globally? I mean, that's the challenge that we have in the world today, is that we now have about over 7.5 billion people in the world. 5 billion are connected to this new technology that makes everybody more vulnerable or more likely to be a participant. And we haven't thought about these issues this way. And what we're seeing in the question that comes to cities that was raised is we're having a mass of humanity in cities and urban locales that don't have the resources, like the water. So we have water mafias now. We have people building, which means we're having illicit trade in timber. And what we're having is a mining of the world's resources that we need to maintain a sustainable planet. And that's where a lot of this activity is going. And to what I'm saying is, organized crime has always gone into time-sensitive activities, like garbage, like fish markets. And now they're going after the resources of the planet, because we're a time-sensitive planet. And we see this most acutely in our urban areas of the world. And this is a global problem. And while we're talking globally, maybe we're withdrawing from the Paris Agreement, but the rest of the, but our cities are involved in this, and the rest of the world is thinking about global climate change. But we're not thinking enough about the illicit actors and also state actors and corporate actors that are mining and directing illicit activity towards the products that we need to live on this planet. And that's where the global growth, according to all statistics, is greatest and I perceive as most damaging. And that's what I'm focusing on now.
Louise, there's one question that Vicky raised. How can we all be like Denmark?
What is it
that's special about Denmark?
All right.
That makes it, in, you know, not only Transparency International, but there are a number of
all
studies.
Right. All right. Well, Denmark, up until recently, has been a very homogeneous society. But one time I flew back from an international TI meeting, sitting next to a Danish investigator of corruption, who was describing to me in quite detail how his life had been threatened within Denmark, because he was investigating Danish overseas corruption. And so he was saying that there's an enormous problem, that Danes at home are very anti-corruption and law-abiding within their society, but as multinational corporations, they're not. And that they, and the number of threats that he had in Denmark and requiring police protection was evidence of this. I mean, I listened to this for hours, and this man was not paranoid. He was one of the chief anti-corruption investigators of Denmark. So the question comes to be, what are your standards domestically and what are your standards internationally? And that comes back to this issue of NATO. And do we have one standard for domestic consumption and another standard of behavior when we behave outside of our countries? And I think that this is important, and we need to be thinking this way, not just of how we guard our little garden at home, but how we garden our planet.
Sebastian, and then Juliet, if you have any comments to add.
Yeah, thank you very much. Maybe I'll start with the question of the acceptance of a certain level of corruption. I'd like to differentiate between accept, tolerate, and amplify it when we do something in a mission. Maybe we have to accept it because of the cultural, historical roots, but our aim should be to eradicate it through transparency. But this could not be done at once. And if we have a counterpart with whom we deal, we assist or advise in our missions, we should not blame him directly. We should accept his behavior and in a long term try to turn his behavior into that what we aim on, transparency, good governance, accountability. But if you do it at once, then you have a problem. On a more higher level, what I stated in my comments, we should not amplify it by overwhelming societies with money and goods and not looking to whom we give it. The next question, I'd like to modify a little bit about the ingredients of a non-corrupt state like Denmark. So what does it mean for us military when we go on mission? So we should look that, for example, in the defense sector, that the people are have a decent salary, like I stated. So I think all of us in the room have a good salary so we can live on. We don't come on, to the idea to be corrupt because we don't need it. But if you have 8 children in Afghanistan, you don't get your salary on time, and you get only a small salary, then you might get corrupt out of force because you have to survive. And this is why I criticize a little bit the definition of Transparency International, who blames only the guy, the official guy, who accepts corruption, because you have to see the whole context and the circumstances. And again, this local ownership is an issue. We should think about it if we should hand all our money and finance directly to the government, that the government is responsible for paying the salaries, for example. We could do it and hand it over on a certain stage. Because corruption, as stated, is entangled. You need a good law enforcement. If there is no law enforcement, which I have to fear, then I can be corrupt. But if there is a good law enforcement, a good government, and maybe another thing, a good education, the ethical education, like our code of conduct in NATO. We have it in our military trainings. You wrote in your book one example that counterfeit DVDs are sold in camps in Afghanistan. Yeah, everybody who was in Afghanistan or in mission, at least from the German side, we have to sign before we enter the state that we don't buy this stuff. And so we have to fear our law enforcement. So it's everything is entangled, and you cannot stovepipe it like you said. And yeah, I think I hand over to you. This should be enough.
Very briefly, just a very quick comment, and then I can only tackle one of those questions. The rest of them are beyond me. But thank you for the bit about Hammurabi code and the read across. That's lovely. And there's also a good little chunk in the book about history being part of the reason for some of the things we see now, along the lines of the comments that you made earlier. The bit about the trafficking routes, the slave routes, the camel routes, the Silk Road. Okay. It's lovely. And it's perfectly true, because Mukhtar Bil Mukhtar is known as Mr. Cigarettes because he smuggles cigarettes as well as drugs, as well as support to Al-Qaeda. It makes no difference. He uses the old trade routes, and he makes a profit. The only question I can even tackle is the last one about what do we do internationally? And it's not terribly sexy at all, because I think the things that we need to do are the stuff we do, which is the issues of norms and best practice sharing. When something works, you need to communicate that to other people. And so international fora, NATO is a very marginal one for a lot of these issues, but the UN definitely, perhaps the OSCE, perhaps on the terrorism side, the Global Counterterrorism Forum. Anywhere where you bring together a community with a common interest and you share best practices, that has got to be an unsexy but a practical, useful thing to do. One other example I can think of at the moment is the twinning arrangement that is being done between cities, so that a city that has addressed some of its crime problems, or maybe how to construct a city that's not quite so vulnerable to bomb attacks or something like that, is twinned with a city that is suffering from a great deal of vulnerability, but it's not a planned city, so it is already missed the being able to engineer it as the city grows up. But perhaps it can retro-engineer some stuff, building on examples from those who have got it right through experience further down the development track. Thank you.
Thank you to our panelists and to Louise. I wanted to add a comment about the question we had about acceptable levels of corruption. I don't know if there's an acceptable level or a level that you can tolerate, but in our network of building integrity, we work with the private sector, and I've asked them this question of what, they now have vice presidents responsible for reducing corruption or ethical behavior, good governance. They have different titles. So we've asked them, how do they view this? And they spend a lot of money on training and education as well, It's not just that you sign the code of conduct when you join. They have annual training and refresher training at all levels. And in my conversations with them, they have come to the conclusion that somewhere between 3% and 5%, you know, once you get it down to that level, these are multinational companies, that, you know, the return on investment, if you're going to do continual education and training, you know, kind of costs you more to do the training than, you know, you're going to save. So in terms of, you know, the private sector, they've looked at this, and their estimate, you know, I share with you, is somewhere between 3 and 5%. Now, discussion we've had in our team is now, if all the NATO nations are going to raise their level of spending to this 2%, this also increases the corruption risk, because there's going to be, you know, lots of bad actors there who will want a piece of this new defense spending. So we have to think about, how do we make our systems more resilient, and how do you reduce the risk of corruption? Because if you, I mean, we did the math, and there's a considerable amount of money if you even think that, you know, 5% is at risk for NATO nations. So I think the solution we came to is that you have to be vigilant. I have Sebastian's disease this morning. But you also have to focus on systems and education training. So that's why our effort at NATO is not on detection and prosecution. There are others who are better able to do that. But we look at how can we strengthen systems and prepare individuals for their jobs, that they're trained to carry out the tasks in the Ministry of Defense or the national security apparatus. So that's one of the conclusions that we've come to. I'm conscious of the time. Can I ask Louise if you have any final words of wisdom, and then I'm going to invite you all to join us for a glass of something sparkly. Catherine is there to remind us of our timekeeping. So, Louise, do you have any final words before I hand over to Catherine?
There's just one final piece that I wrote about in this Dirty Entanglements, that it takes two to tangle. And so it's not just a problem of the developing world, it's a problem of the developed world. And one of the things that we have seen in this consequences of corruption is that a huge amount of this money has moved into real estate in major developing countries, major developed countries. And today, as a result of activity and urging by NGOs, academics, others, there has been measures put in place in the U.S. and measures in some of the sending countries to prevent this money from leaving. And so today I was reading the Financial Times about how all of a sudden some of the luxury real estate in New York is not being sold, because some of these kleptocrats have not been able to move it into New York real estate. And this is a kind of, I think this is progress. And I think we need to think sometimes about solutions that are creative and involve the business world, and not put everything on the military like NATO for things that you can't control. There are other measures that are sometimes, they may be costly for others, but not costly in terms of life and national treasure, that can be effective as well. And that's what we need to think about, and not put your personnel and their lives on the line.
Thank you very much. I'm sure that's a sentiment that will be well received by this audience. So thank you very much, Louise and Juliet and Sebastian. And Catherine, and back to you.
Okay. Well, thank you to the panel. I think a round of applause for some very thoughtful and thought-provoking. And a reminder, with the cocktail, of course, is the opportunity to mingle with the panel, to discuss some of these topics a bit more, and to buy the book, because it's available, and to get your pamphlet. As always, this was a team effort. There are actually four IS divisions and one IMS division involved in making this all happen. So big thanks to PDD for their support with the facility, the interpreters for making it possible to understand, and as always, to Isabel and the Multimedia Library team who do all the work behind the scenes that actually makes it happen. So please join Susan and the panel.
Thank you.
And committee, remember we're back on at 1:45.
Thank you so much.
Oh, well, thank you very much. I can imagine that your students...